The headlines, Iran says it's a 20% uranium enrichment fully conforms to the JCPOA and is a reaction to other signatories' non-compliance with the deal. Saudi Arabia is set to reopen its borders with Qatar as a years-long blockade by Riyadh and regional allies fails to force Doha to bow to their demands. And riot police in Istanbul uses water cannons to quell students protesting against Turkish President Erdogan's appointment of a new rector at the top university. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran says it has produced the first batch of 20% enriched uranium at the presence of IAEA inspectors at its Fordo facility. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the measure is a remedial action after years of noncompliance by the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal.
It was on May 8, 2018, when the U.S. president unilaterally withdrew Washington from the internationally recognized 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Following the pullout, Donald Trump left no stone unturned to implement his so-called policy of maximum pressure on Tehran. In line with his policy, Trump not only reimposed sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the agreement, but also came out with several new crippling measures against the Islamic Republic. In May 2019, Iran notified the remaining signatories to the JCPOA that Tehran would roll back some of its commitments under the deal. It cited failure of the signatories to secure the Islamic Republic's interest, in particular in oil and banking sectors, in the face of Washington's pullout and sanctions. But Britain, Germany, and France, known as E3, failed to take any practical measures, even during the coronavirus pandemic, when U.S. sanctions hampered Iran's efforts to purchase medicines and medical equipment. In the wake of Europe's inaction, the Iranian parliament passed a law last month. It called on the government to produce at least 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually and store it inside the country. In line with the legislation, Iran started the process to enrich uranium to 20% purity at its Fordo nuclear facility on Monday, a move that was confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Agency and carried out under the presence of its inspectors. And hours later, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced that the first batch of 20% uranium was produced. Iran's foreign minister defended the measure, saying it conforms with the JCPOA.
A remedial action conforms fully with paragraph 36 of JCPOA after years of non-compliance by several other JCPOA participants. Our measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by all.
Zarif's assertions was echoed by the former ambassador of Iran to the IAEA, who is currently a senior consultant at the United Nations.
Each member state or each party to NPT could reach to any level that they require for their consumptions that they have. The only obligation is to inform the IAEA to verify their declaration.
Iran has maintained that its steps to reduce its JCPOA commitments are completely and quickly reversible as soon as the U.S. and Europe return to their own commitments under the deal. Now the ball is in the court of Europe and the incoming administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to practically show whether they are determined to salvage the deal.
Tell us it's clear. Tell us it's clear and convincing.
OPEC and non-OPEC countries are set to resume their talks on Tuesday. after reaching a deadlock over production levels for the next month. A virtual meeting of OPEC Plus group on Monday saw Saudi Arabia arguing against pumping more due to coronavirus lockdowns, with Russia-led calls for higher production, citing recovery demand. Reports say Kazakhstan also backed a raising production, while Iraq, Nigeria, and the United Arab Emirates wanted to keep output steady. OPEC Plus meeting came after the pandemic tanked the market for crude in 2020. In the previous meeting, members agreed to raise production by 500,000 barrels per day in January. At the same meeting, they agreed to meet each month to decide on any adjustments to production volumes for the following month. Moving on, Kuwait says Saudi Arabia is lifting a border blockade on Qatar 3 years after Riyadh and some of its regional allies instigated measures to isolate Doha.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al-Ahmed Al-Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
The Kuwaiti foreign minister also said a declaration toward resolving the political dispute is expected to be signed at a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday. Qatar's royal court also said Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani has accepted an invitation to attend the summit. The 2017 Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, broke its ties with Qatar, issuing a 13-point list of demands. They included the closure of the Al Jazeera television network and a downgrade of relations with Iran in return for reconciliation. Qatar has long rejected the demands as unreasonable. Activist and commentator Robert Fantina says Saudi Arabia and its allies have been unable to force Qatar to bow to their wishes.
It gained nothing, which is why it is now willing to, it says, negotiate a resolution to it. Saudi Arabia and the other countries that joined in the blockade and issued the 13-point demands were simply trying to force Qatar to bend to their wishes, which Qatar wasn't willing to do. So the blockade resulted in no significant damage to the Qatari economy. The demands, the 13 demands, were all ridiculous in that they simply, if Qatar had given into them, it would have just been surrendering its own sovereignty because of the demands that were made by these countries.
A bomb explosion has reportedly targeted a U.S.-led coalition convoy north of the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Local media cited a security source as saying that the blast ripped through the convoy carrying logistical equipment in Saladin Governorate. The source said the explosion caused no casualties. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Tensions escalated after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and a senior Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in January 2020. Iraqi people have time and again called for the expulsion of U.S. troops from their country. Turkish police clash with students protesting against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's appointment of a new rector at one of the country's top universities. Police used water cannons to quell a demonstration in Istanbul. Students were calling for the resignation of the new rector, arguing that his appointment process was undemocratic. Some students who were able to enter the campus sealed one of the university's buildings. Istanbul police did not immediately comment. The new rector is the first to be chosen from outside the university since a military coup in Turkey in 1980. U.S. President Donald Trump and President-elect Joe Biden joined their respective party mates in Georgia to campaign for the crucial Senate runoff race. The outgoing president is set to address a rally in the city of Dalton, while his Democratic successor is campaigning in Atlanta. The two incumbent Republican lawmakers and their Democratic contenders are vying for Senate seats. The race will determine which party would gain the edge in the current Republican-controlled Senate. The January 5th runoff comes amid Trump's repeated claims of voter fraud and inconsistencies in the November presidential election, allegations that Georgia state officials have rejected.
Again, this is all easily, provably false, yet the president persists. And by doing so, undermines Georgians' faith in the election system, especially Republican Georgians in this case, which is important because we have a big election coming up tomorrow.
The comments come a day after a leaked audio file revealed the president was pressing Georgia's Secretary of State to find him votes. Trump and his allies insist the presidential vote was rigged in favor of Biden, but they have lost dozens of court efforts seeking to reverse the results. The Congress is set to hold a joint session on January the 6th when Biden's victory is expected to be officially certified. U.S. endures the deadliest week of the coronavirus pandemic with more than 18,000 deaths at the vaccine rollouts. According to the Johns Hopkins University tally, one COVID death was reported in the U.S. every 33 seconds. December was also the deadliest month since the start of the pandemic. Health officials have warned that more people are likely to die in January. So far, more than 353,000 fatalities have been reported out of over 20,780,000 confirmed cases. The country continues to report a steep rise in cases despite the rollout of COVID vaccines. The governors of New York and Florida have warned that they would reduce a future allocation to those hospitals that fail to dispense shots quickly enough. Now, it was a Christmas of hardship and isolation for many in Italy due to the harsh impact of the pandemic on the country's economy. A new report says 4 million Italians had to seek financial help to receive proper meals during this Christmas season. Max Civilli has more.
Christmas holidays are almost over in Italy. It's been a particularly testing time for many as the country is struggling to recover from the economic slowdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic. A study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that about 4 million Italians have been seeking help, many for the first time, to put food on the table during these Christmas festivities. The association has warned the number of people needing food support has doubled compared to last year.
These figures give a snapshot of what the current economic situation is in Italy. 4 million people had to resort to soup kitchens or food pantries this Christmas due to the anti-COVID restrictions. The situation is rapidly aggravating, with our estimates indicating that this year many more will join the ranks of the poor.
About one-third of all people seeking help in Italy during the pandemic are first-time recipients, charitable groups have warned. In a reversal of usual trends, most are Italians and not foreign residents.
According to Coldiretti, among the new poor in Italy, there are those who have lost their jobs, small traders or artisans who were forced to shut down, people employed in the underground economy who do not enjoy special subsidies or public aid and have no savings or assets to fall back on.
E quindi diventa sempre più difficile
The economic crisis caused by the pandemic is wreaking havoc, especially among the middle classes. We weren't expecting this to happen so quickly.
Some have lost their job. Some others work much less compared to pre-COVID times. Some friends of mine couldn't buy presents. Some had to give up many other things. It's really hard for an increasing number of people.
The government is reportedly looking at extending the current restrictions until January 15, meaning that non-essential shops will be closed and bars and restaurants can only do takeaway services during weekends. A major question is whether Italy's high schools will reopen as planned on January 7. Max Civili, Rome.
Now a British court in London has ruled that WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange cannot be extradited to the U.S. The judge blocked the request because of concerns over Assange's mental health and risk of suicide in the U.S. Ahmed Cabello has the details.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Yes. Yes. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
Situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US, and internationally. Because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Cabello, London.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
BioNTech has criticized the EU's failure to order more doses of its coronavirus vaccine, saying it is now racing with its US partner, Pfizer, to boost production amid fears of a European gap left by the lack of other approved vaccines. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was the first to be approved by the bloc late last month, after being accepted by the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States. They and other countries have also since approved the Moderna or Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, leaving the European Union trailing behind. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists John Henley, Kate Connolly, and Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled, BioNTech Criticizes EU Failure to Order Enough COVID Vaccine. BioNTech has criticized the EU's failure to order more doses of its coronavirus vaccine, saying it is now racing with its US partner, Pfizer, to boost production amid fears of a European gap left by the lack of other approved vaccines. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was the first to be approved by the bloc late last month, after being accepted by the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States. They and other countries have also since approved the Moderna and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, leaving the European Union trailing behind. With criticism growing of the slow pace of the European Union's vaccine program, Ugur Shaheen, the head of the German biotech firm BioNTech, told Der Spiegel that the order process in Europe certainly did not go as fast and as smooth as it did with other countries. Ugur Shaheen, who founded BioNTech with his wife, Özlem Türeci, the firm's chief medical officer, said the situation was not rosy, as the European Union had wrongly assumed several different vaccines would be ready at once, so spread its orders. The assumption was that many other companies would come up with their vaccines, Shaheen said. It would seem that the impression was, we'll get enough, it won't be so bad, and we have this under control. It surprised me. Türeci told the magazine the EU had assumed there would be a basket of different suppliers to choose from. Such an approach makes sense, but then at some point it became clear that many would be unable to deliver so quickly, she said. By that time, it was too late to make up for under-ordering. The United States ordered 600 million doses of the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine in July, while the European Union waited until November to order half as many. Shaheen said the firms were now working flat out to increase production and fill a hole due to a lack of other approved vaccines. He said BioNTech aimed to get a new manufacturing plant up and running in Marburg, Germany this February, far earlier than planned. It should be able to produce 250 million doses in the first half of 2021. Türeci said the firm had also signed deals with five other pharmaceutical companies in Europe to increase production and were negotiating with others. By the end of January, we should have clarity on how much more we can produce, Shahin said. The Moderna vaccine should be cleared on 6th of January by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, which is under mounting pressure to quickly approve the Oxford vaccine, which was cleared this week by Britain. Delays in producing and distributing the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine have caused consternation in Germany, where the focus has been on immunizing elderly people in care homes, and some regions have had to halt vaccination programs within days of starting them. Germany's health minister, Jens Spahn, said earlier this week he had been bombarded with mail from people complaining about citizens not getting quick enough access to the vaccine, despite it being made in Germany. The health minister, Jens Spahn, defended the European Union health minister's decision to take a united approach rather than each country operating alone, arguing that having a united front meant smaller, less wealthy member states could have access to it at the same time as wealthier nations. Germany's health minister, Jens Spahn, said Germany, which has so far inoculated 130,000 people, had taken delivery of 1.3 million doses of the vaccine so far. But some of the 400-plus vaccine centers have had to temporarily close due to a lack of supplies. There have been similar complaints in France, where just 322 people have been vaccinated so far, prompting the French government to promise that healthcare workers aged over 50 could get the vaccine from Monday, sooner than originally planned. Italy has so far vaccinated 8,300 people, and Spain said it was on track to have administered 1.3 million doses of the vaccine. A spokesperson for the French government, Gabriel Attal, defended the pace of France's campaign on Friday, saying it was targeting care homes for the elderly and was not going to judge a vaccination campaign that will last 6 months on a few days. France's health minister, Olivier Véran, announced on Thursday evening that the vaccine would be made available earlier than planned to older healthcare workers. Ministers and officials had been accused of pandering to anti-vaxxers by going too slowly. Some of you have questioned the rhythm of the COVID-19 vaccination program in France a few days after it began in Europe, Olivier Véran, the health minister, said. He tweeted, "Some countries have already vaccinated a lot, others haven't started. Be reassured, the vaccine campaign will soon pick up speed. The vaccine is a historic opportunity to end this epidemic and return to normal life, and we will not miss it." In his New Year address, French President Emmanuel Macron said he will not allow an unjustified delay in the inoculation of the population to happen for bad reasons. President Macron called on people to trust their doctors and scientists. French officials have admitted they were taking a marathon, not a sprint approach to vaccination after running into strong public opposition. A European-wide opinion poll by Ipsos showed that only 40% of the French public questioned said they were willing to have a COVID-19 jab. France says those receiving the vaccine must give written consent after being fully informed of possible side effects of the vaccine and time to consider whether they want it or not. Opposition politicians and doctors have criticized this approach.
food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and for your information, the Prophet of Islam's divinely designated successor, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, said in one of his sermons, "If you like, I will tell you about Jesus, the son of Mary. He used a stone as his pillow, wore coarse clothing, and ate rough food. His stew was hunger, and his lamp in the night was the moon. His shade in the winter was the east of the earth and its west. His fruit and his basil were what grew from the earth for the cattle. He had no wife to try him, and no son to grieve him. He had no wealth to distract him, nor greed to abase him. He had no mount to ride but his feet, and none were his servants but his own two hands."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. Today, inshallah, we're going to talk about how we can teach our children to be content with the blessings they're given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So how do we teach our children to do that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And contentment and qana'at in Arabic, we call it, is a very important ingredient of taqwa. And there are very many ahadiths we can get to that. In fact, sabr and shukr are the sabr, that is patience, and shukr, that is gratitude,
yeah.
which is contentment, actually. Gratitude, that whatever you have, you know, you're thankful of, are the key elements to build piety in a believer. But of course, they have to be worked from in a young age, you know, towards these characteristics. And these are good habits inculcated in the children without telling them, of course. Once that those good habits are formed, then they can easily understand
yeah.
when the lifestyle is set on how to behave, you know, the behavioral patterns are set on how to go about their lives. And then they will understand what is contentment
yeah.
later on as
and
they grow up.
And I think also that when, you know, you have given your child their needs and you've given them that love and attention, you've made them full, you know, they feel like they don't need now to go for other things. They feel this contentment, at least from their parents. It's like a starting, you know, step to realize that, you know, there is a way of getting content. So basically, like what we've been talking about, you know, getting content from home, it's like the main thing.
The biggest
yeah.
Way to start, right? To get the contentment materially.
Exactly.
Because what we are going to mostly emphasize on is the material contentment.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes parents do give all the love and attention to their children, but there's a way of extravagance, luxury, practiced at home, that the children feel now they're habituated in that kind of thing, the
exactly.
best of everything. You know, buying more and more and more, getting the best of everything.
And they'll not get
full. Not being
full.
Satisfied.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the contentment, actually, to define it, is having a low style but good livelihood with excessive love of life. Love in a person's life.
Mm-hmm.
Excessive. That's important to
yeah.
have, you know, the proper needs fulfilled of love and attention. And, of course, practicing moderation in everything. So it doesn't mean that a person who is having this contentment in him can't aspire and can't wish or can't have ambitions. It's not contrary to that. You can still have ambitions, because an ambition person, actually the emphasis here is on struggling, to struggle. So when you struggle, and of course you may achieve or you may not achieve according to what you wanted.
But that's the whole process. It's
yeah,
like
there's a whole process. And then you are... contentment comes in the way
yeah.
to make you feel that now this is what is decreed for me, right? This is my happiness. It's Allah's happiness in the best that was designed for me. So,
but how to instill this in a small child?
Yeah, through habituating him,
okay.
of course. And we'll talk about it how. So, the truth is, most of us have never really been in need or have been really like hungry or for no like extra food or something. We've not experienced. Hardly we see people experiencing this kind of a situation. So we tend to replace the word want with the word need. You know what I mean? Like, we need, what we need we get from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but it's what we want that makes us in discontent. It's what we want that makes a child discontent. And it starts from a very young age, when, you know, you shower a child with whatever he wants.
Very true. That's very interesting. So we'll take a short break, and inshallah we'll continue with this discussion after the break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. And this is Islamic Upbringing. So the question we had was, how should we instill, you know, this sense of contentment in our children? And you were telling us that we have to habituate them from when they're young.
When they're young, like whatever they wish for, we shouldn't always gratify them with whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make them feel like a feeling of satisfaction in a way that they have everything that they needed. Like the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in his hadith has mentioned that kun ani antakun ashkurun nas. That means be contented so that you may be the most thankful of the people. And you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam is also mentioned in a hadith, أغنى الناس القانع, the wealthiest of all the people is the one who is contented. So make that feeling come out in a child that he has got everything, even if it's like two small toys that he has ahead of him, with him. Make that appear so special for him that they're satisfied with that, you know, using your creativity.
This needs a lot of tact,
It needs a lot of tact, and it needs a lot of your own role modeling also, how content you are. Sometimes it's the parents who spoil the children by this discontentment, that, no, we buy for our children whatever he wants, or, you know, this is not in fashion, so my child will wear whatever is in fashion, or, no, my child even needs, you know, the best clothes, the marked clothes. So we make a child, you know, like get interested in these things.
Or we feel like we want everything very easy. So we want everything to be easy for us. So we want to get all the different sorts of machines for every single thing possible, because why, we don't want to sit and maybe chop something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really, and that's actually what brings about discontentment in life later on, if he faces a difficult situation.
Exactly.
If the child faces a difficult situation. So this is a trait that has many uses in the future life, and it also mentally affects the child, because it prevents greed in the child.
Yeah.
Greed is a lesson. When he's content, you know, a content child is a happy child, so he doesn't need anything. Once he's told, you know, this is the best way possible, you can use this, and it can be it has multi uses, and it's the best way to pass your time, you know, the child would need more. There are many games, for example, you know, sometimes it so happens that the child is given expensive items. So due to this expensive items, now when he gets a gift of a cheap item, he'll feel, oh, this is just this.
This is what?
I'm not interested in this. I get better gifts than that.
Exactly.
So he doesn't learn to appreciate. So the children do most mistakes by getting expensive things for their children, rather than starting off with the cheap small balloons for them, to get that excitement come in them, that this is so good.
Yeah, this is small, but something. You know?
I believe that even intangible gifts are the best gifts also. For example, you know, spiritual gifts. I once talked about it in one of my questions. Spiritual gifts are very important, but take them for granted. But if we instill them from a young age, you'll see a child taking interest in those spiritual gifts.
Yeah.
And I've experienced that. Actually take interest that, oh, you give me this many salawats, my nani court. And though they don't know very much the concept of it, but it appears so beautiful for the parent that the child even gets interested.
Exactly, that's very true, inshallah, that we will be able to do this. We're just going to take a short break, and inshallah we'll get back on this after the break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, be just between your children when giving something.
Okay, so welcome back, your audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about how we can practice moderation with our children, because that will help them get content. So you are telling us more about this.
Yeah, I mentioned role modeling is very important in this, that the parent themselves should be satisfied so that they can instill this satisfaction in the child. So the parent don't have this satisfaction, they'll always buy maybe the best toys. Maybe they'll feel that I want to satisfy my child with the most expensive toys, and the child will then not learn to appreciate the things that are given to him of something that is cheaper.
And what about, you know, like right now, because of the social media, also marketing, it's like everywhere you see the adverts, they show that how children have so many good things, and it makes the child feel like, oh, we want that too. And basically this is how the whole marketing system works, yeah? They show these different kind of products, and they make the child feel like, oh, we want this, and we want that, and we want that. Will this help, you know, make practicing moderation with our children? Will this help in them not getting, you know, infatuated with all these kind of very eye-catching products and eye-catching games and toys and things like this? How can we make it close it down for them?
Yeah, it's a good question, you say. And I guess we could still do it, but by role modeling. Like, for example, not lay so importance on these things ourselves. If ourselves, we lay so much importance in them, then the children will feel. Like, for example, if some marketing is done and some advertisements are shown and we open our eyes wide enough to say, wow, this is so good, this is the best kind of quality, then of course the children will get it in the mind that this is something that I need and I want, for example. He may even confuse his need for his want. You know, that's not what he needs, actually, what we have. And you can explain him that what you want actually is there with me also just now. It's there with us. Because these days it's hardly like possible to have a home without a computer or a tablet, right? We have at least one in our homes. So we can satisfy them with that also, right? Yeah. There's so many things that... And then also educate them that these things won't give you the real kind of satisfaction. You know, there are so many children, like, give them examples. There are so many children who have the best things of everything, but they perform so dull in class. I remember in my time also, like, there were people who had the best kind of stationery, but they had the lowest marks. And there was a girl who had a small pencil, and she used to do her tests with that small pencil. She was from a very poor family, and she brought the best marks. So it always was like a big question mark in my mind. It's not everything that you have that you perform in that way. That doesn't pave the way to success. Mm. You want to get success, you live moderately. Don't kill the desires, of course. You shouldn't kill those desires, but moderate them.
So, for example, maybe if you want them to work harder, you'll say, you'll give them a nice pencil so that they can, you know, try and it can maybe motivate them.
Yeah.
So I guess it's all done like in a kind of way. Maybe, for instance, those parents gave their children a lot of things so that, you know, they can study well. Or sometimes, like, we can never, like, judge a situation, yeah? It's so confusing sometimes, and that's why you have to be very careful with how we, you know, act with our children.
And also, we should make them smart enough in the process that these are just advertisements.
Yeah.
They want people to sell their property or the market, you know, the business. It's just for business. It's not something that is so, you know, special or something. And things get, you know, like, spoiled always. Material things get spoiled. It's not something that will remain completely. And every time new models will be coming out anyway. So
and
you want that
more
one,
and
it'll never end.
It's never ending.
No. And that's a big israf. And of course, that concept of israf then should be brought about. In many ways it can be brought about. That inshallah, I'll talk about it.
Inshallah. Also. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. So dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, bi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
France has been the scene of social violence recently. People in France are protesting against a draft controversial security law. The legislation, known as the Global Security Bill, restricts filming on duty police officers. Article 24 of the proposed bill makes it a criminal offence to publish images of on-duty police officers with the intent to harm their physical or psychological integrity. It says offenders could face up to a year in prison and be fined €45,000. French citizens fear that France is becoming a police state. They believe that the regime in Paris wants to limit their freedoms. Protesters describe the bill as France's way of curbing freedoms while preaching their importance to others. According to France's police watchdog, the IPGN, there were almost 1,500 complaints against officers last year, half of them for alleged violence. The timing of this bill couldn't be worse. It was voted right after a video was circulating online of the brutal arrest of a black music producer for not wearing a mask. The United Nations Human Rights Chief also urged France to withdraw a controversial part of its global security bill that would curb the freedom to share images identifying police. There's much truth to this statement. In France, it seems that racism and hatred against minorities and people of color is historic. France was a colonialist empire. The first colonial empire in France began in 1534, and the second colonial empire began in 1830. For example, Bordeaux was France's second largest slave port and prospered off the lucrative trade, deporting 150,000 African slaves to the Americans from 1672 to 1837 and providing Europe with goods such as cocoa, sugar, and cotton. These historic realities are not mentioned on the banners. The new sign for the statue of slave trader David Gradis, who lived from 1665 to 1751 in the French city of Bordeaux, explains that he had 10 slave ships and provided a plot of land that became the city's first Jewish cemetery. It says nothing about his slave deals with American settlers. Another controversial statue is that of deceased colonizer Louis Faidherbe in the northern city of Lille, France. In the decades following the French Revolution and Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo back in 1815, a new movement called Romanticism began to flourish in France. France, through many liberal and social movements, tried to paint a different picture of its past. But even the French president recently emphasized that France is the same as it always was and won't change its past. But racism is not the only problem in France. Recently, there has been a spike of Islamophobia there. After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking another round of popular protests against it too. France guarantees the freedom of religion by virtue of the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. The Republic is based on the principle of laicity, that is, of freedom of religion enforced by Jules Ferry laws and the 1905 Law on the Separation of the State and the Church. Paris has traditionally been associated with alternative artistic or intellectual subcultures, many of which involved foreigners. But it seems that things have changed in France, especially with the rise of Muslim immigrants there and across Europe. France's Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. Paris has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation and Muslims. The bill comes after outrage in the aftermath of a measure by French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which reprinted offensive caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in October of 2020. Charlie Hebdo's measure drew strong criticism from Muslims in France and Muslim countries, who called it an Islamophobic act, despite which French President Emmanuel Macron refused to condemn the measure, citing freedom of expression and claiming that it was not right for a political leader to get involved in editorial matters. The cartoons were originally published by the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten in 2005 and then republished by Charlie Hebdo in 2006. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims. The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money. In 1990, riots are triggered after two North Africans are shot dead. Also that same year, thousands of people commemorate killing of 17-year-old Moroccan in a racist incident. In 1991, police clash with French Arabs and North Africans. In 1992, tens of thousands of protesters take to the streets to demand change against racism. In 1993, the government approves a draft law to reinstate key provisions of its immigration law declared unconstitutional a month earlier. In 1997, thousands of protesters demonstrated across France against proposed legislation that would further tighten immigration controls. Minorities in France, whether people of color or Muslims, believe that the situation nowadays has got even worse. With the rise of police brutality against blacks and the rise in Islamophobia, supported directly by the state, they're going to have to live with new realities in a nation that has long preached human rights values and democracy while covering up its controversial racist and colonialist past.
Arabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
The limelight.
As countries like Greece and Hungary have made it more difficult for migrants and refugees to reach the wealthier nations of the European Union, Bosnia-Herzegovina has in recent years become a central point of passage for those making their way into the European continent. The Balkan nation is not part of the European Union, but it shares more than two-thirds of its borders with Croatia, a member state. While 750 migrants were recorded passing through Bosnia in 2017, there were over 29,000 in 2019. That number